My fellow in the school was Francesco Totti. He's 1 year older than me, but we were in the same elementary school when we were kids.
Tell me about Francesco Totti. Who is he?
Francesco Totti? You don't know Francesco Totti. No. Shame on you.
Yeah. I don't.
Hey und herzlich willkommen zum Elbphilharmonie Talk. Ich bin Julika aus dem Team der Elbphilharmonie und ich sitze hier mit meinem Kollegen Tom. Hallo lieber Tom.
Hallo Julika.
Tom, du hast für diese Folge mit dem italienischen Dirigenten Riccardo Minasi gesprochen. Er ist mindestens europaweit ein sehr gefragter Dirigent, steht am Pult von so Weltklasseorchestern wie den Berliner Philharmonikern, ist Opernchef in Genua und so weiter. Ursprünglich kommt er ja aber eigentlich von der Geige, darüber sprecht ihr ja auch ziemlich ausführlich. Ich muss sagen, ich war echt erstaunt, dass er da nur so reingerutscht ist eigentlich.
Ja, das ist er, glaube ich, auch immer noch selbst ein bisschen erstaunt darüber, wie sich das so gefügt hat, weil es war in seinem Lebensplan nicht vorgesehen, hat aber jetzt im Grunde, hat das Dirigieren, das Geigen für ihn nahezu verdrängt, kann man sagen. Und er musste sich ganz viel Repertoire im Grunde dann als erwachsener Musiker erst drauf schaffen, weil er eben nie Korrepetitor gewesen war. Er hat natürlich auch noch ein bisschen nachstudiert sozusagen, auch noch technische Unterrichtsstunden genommen, einfach um sich da sicherer zu fühlen und keinen Unfug zu machen. Aber es ist wirklich ein Learning by Doing gewesen von jemandem, der einfach ein exzellenter Musiker ist. Das muss man natürlich sagen. Der hat ja auch als Ensemblegründer und so natürlich viel Erfahrung gehabt, einfach mit Musikern zu arbeiten und auch eine Klangvorstellung so zu artikulieren, dass Leute mitgehen und verstehen, was er meint. Wenn er das nicht mitbringen würde, wäre es wahrscheinlich nicht so weit, so schnell so oder nicht so schnell so weit mit ihm gekommen, wie es jetzt ihm geglückt ist.
Mit Hamburg und der Elbphilharmonie ist er jetzt ja schon einige Jahre sehr eng verbunden, denn er ist aktuell Principal Guest Conductor beim Ensemble Resonanz, so nennen die das. Das Ensemble ist ein sehr innovatives und ziemlich erfolgreiches Ensemble mit Sitz im Bunker hier bei uns auf St. Pauli. Und sie sind seit Eröffnung der Elbphilharmonie Residenzensemble bei uns im kleinen Saal und gestalten gleich mehrere Konzerte in der Saison, darunter einige so Education-Programme, aber eben auch diese größere Konzertreihe Resonanzen. Das heißt, auch Riccardo Minasi ist ja ziemlich regelmäßig hier bei uns im Haus. Eigentlich müsste euer Gespräch längst überfällig gewesen sein. Wie gut kanntet ihr euch schon?
Wir kannten uns gar nicht vorher. Das passiert öfter, dass man mit Musikern spricht, die man natürlich schon lange verfolgt und kennt und man weiß um ihren Ruhm und um ihren Nimbus und dann hat man die Gelegenheit, sie zu befragen. Und bei Riccardo war es einfach so, ich habe ihn öfter natürlich auf der Bühne gesehen und habe Konzerte mit ihm gehört und fand das immer sehr beeindruckend, wie alert und wie präzise er arbeitet. Und das hat mich gereizt und er ist ja relativ klein und trotzdem hat er diese funkelnde Ausstrahlung, wenn er auf die Bühne kommt und sowas ganz Energetisches. Und das ist, natürlich rede ich doch gern mal mit ihm.
Du hattest auch die Chance, vorher sogar noch bei einer Probe dabei zu sein, oder?
Das war sehr nett. Das Ensemble Resonanz hatte zugelassen, dass ich da bei der Probe dabei sitze und zwar nicht irgendwo im Publikum, sondern bei ihm im Resonanzraum. Und eine der zweiten Geigen war nicht dabei und dann war da ein Stuhl frei und dann durfte ich mich da hinsetzen und konnte also den Kollegen in ihre iPad-Noten gucken und Riccardo eben im Profil dann doch von relativ nah beobachten bei der Probenarbeit. Und ich hatte ehrlich gesagt ein bisschen den Eindruck, dass das jetzt auch noch für alle Beteiligten so was ein bisschen Besonderes war, dass da jetzt noch jemand von der Presse, sozusagen hätte man das früher so genannt, zuhört. Das heißt, Riccardo hat irgendwie besonders brilliert und besonders witzige Vergleiche gefunden und Ansprachen gehalten. Und die Musiker waren sehr alert und bereit, ihm in allen möglichen Dingen zu folgen. Und es war irgendwie nett. Es war sehr, sehr unterhaltsam und sehr lehrreich, wie Probenbesuche sowieso immer eigentlich das Allertollste der Welt sind.
Ja, da kriegt man Insights, die man so
absolut,
gar nicht ahnt.
Absolut.
Ja. Wobei ich sagen muss, so seine besondere Power und Energie und auch so die Bereitschaft der MusikerInnen, da so voll mitzugehen, die kriegt man auch im Konzert. Also ahnt man das, dass das, ich finde, man sitzt selbst so voll auf der Stuhlkante, weil er so mitreißend ist.
Und ja, aber es ist eben wirklich, es ist eine Arbeitsmagie, will ich es mal nennen, die da entsteht zwischen einem Orchester und einem Dirigenten, weil die müssen sich buchstäblich verstehen. Die müssen verstehen, was sie meinen. Und der Dirigent, die Dirigentin muss irgendwie imstande sein, das so zu artikulieren, dass das sofort auch was wird, sonst ist es ja mühsam. Und bei den beiden, sage ich jetzt schon fast, beim Ensemble und bei Riccardo funktioniert es einfach wirklich auf eine ideale Art, weil die ganz schnell machen, was er sich vorstellt und das dann auch sofort erkennen, dass es gut ist. Und wenn es nicht gut ist, dann machen sie was anderes, aber es ist auch irgendwie sehr dialogisch und sehr nah und sehr kurz von den Täuschen her sozusagen, wie sie miteinander kommunizieren. Das ist total toll.
Bevor wir hier jetzt zu tief einsteigen, du wirst ja mit ihm auch noch darüber sprechen, muss ich vielleicht doch den Finger kurz in die Wunde legen, denn ihr habt nicht nur über Musik, sondern auch über Fußball gesprochen.
Ja, ja, wir haben über Fußball gesprochen und wir haben über einen italienischen Fußballer gesprochen, er vor allem, der mir irgendwie in dem Moment des Gesprächs, weil ich so an seinen Lippen hing, war mir das irgendwie nicht mehr so ganz präsent und gegenwärtig. Es geht um Francesco Totti, die große Legende des italienischen Fußballs. Noch am Leben, aber im Grunde so etwas Ähnliches wie der Franz Beckenbauer Italiens. Und ich war so blöd und habe nicht geschaltet. Ich habe einfach nicht geschaltet. Ich hätte jetzt Francesco Rossi, den schlimmen Torschützenkönig von der WM 82, da, das hätte ich sofort parat gehabt. Aber Totti, nein, war mir nicht so.
Und er kannte den sogar persönlich.
Ja, er kannte ihn persönlich. Und dass ich ihn nicht kannte, war natürlich
unverzeihlich.
Unverzeihlich. Da waren wir schon so nett miteinander, dass er... Was hat er gesagt?
Shame on you.
Ja, ja, ja. Er hat mich nicht geschont. Shame on. Ja, er hat ja recht. Shame on me.
Aber ich meine, immerhin war das Gespräch danach nicht prompt beendet, sondern ihr habt dann irgendwie auf wundersame Art und Weise den Bogen doch noch gespannt hin zu Gemüsebeeten und sonstigen Gartenhobbys. Also ja. Ich glaube, man darf gespannt sein und damit viel Spaß beim Hören.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
So wonderful. I'm sitting here with Riccardo Minasi, the great Italian conductor and violinist, in an almost ungodly morning hour. I have had the great privilege to attend at your rehearsal yesterday, and I could witness how immensely quick you are with your mind, with your words, with your movements, with your presence. And I was just wondering, is that so right from the start in the morning? Do you get up and are perky and... alert.
I don't know if I'm so quick, in fact, but well, you came yesterday in the rehearsal in a moment where we had to organize and to fix a few things in a specific piece in the quickest amount of time as possible. So maybe it was maybe more due to the stress than to the.
So normally the pace would be like a little calmer.
Yeah, normally we are a little bit more calm.
But you are able to do it. And I mean, if I see and hear you play violin, this is just the same thing, you know. It's like incredibly easy. It seems incredibly easy for you to master this instrument. And I don't know how much time can you still dedicate for the violin.
It's becoming more and more difficult, unfortunately. But I must also say that I can organize rehearsals like the one you attended yesterday, thanks to a group like Ensemble Resonance. It's not, let's say, my everyday life. They have the reaction and their response is so quick, like really, they are the instrument I have in my hand. It's really incredible. So, yeah.
Are you still traveling with your violin when you are conducting orchestras?
Nah, not anymore.
I
must confess, not anymore. Simply because in the last few seasons, I had many titles, opera titles. And very often, you know, during the day, maybe you have a rehearsal in the morning, a rehearsal in the evening, in the afternoon, the last thing you want to do is to practice the violin. I'm sorry to say that, but it's unfortunately true. Actually, I had a problem recently because I was traveling with the violin and I forgot it in a taxi completely.
Whoa.
Because I was not used anymore.
Grabbing it and holding it.
Yes, I left it inside the taxi. And thank God that the taxi driver realized that. I said, wait a moment.
In what city was that? Do you remember?
It was in Rome.
In Rome?
Yes. I just arrived, went directly to home and just left it there.
Do they know you in Rome, the cab drivers?
No. No, in which sense?
I mean, like recognizing you as one of the great musician sons of the city.
No,
they don't care.
They don't care. But unfortunately, you know, music in Italy now it's in a big decline since so many decades. Unfortunately, and can you imagine? I did my first concert in Rome just last October.
Are you kidding me?
My very first concert in Rome. As when that was in the last
now fall. You're in your mid-40s, so that was,
yes.
It really took you like decades.
For me, it was a huge event. For the city, for sure not.
But you even have this little orchestra of Roma musicians. I mean, And you would not perform with them, or you would perform in Styriate in Graz or in some other places, but not at home.
Well, it was not an orchestra; it was a chamber ensemble.
Yeah, it's a chamber
ensemble. We were a trio at the beginning, and then with a lute player, we were four people. But except me and the cello player, everyone else was not from Rome. And developed my activity outside from the city. It's also, I must also say that I left Rome when I was 15.
That's early.
And I came back in 2004. Okay. So for a while I was not there.
Making it almost like a good 10 years, right? You were born in 78, so
yes.
Yeah, you left 90 something.
Yeah.
93.
More than 10 years, in fact.
So who did you conduct then when you did your first concert in Rome? Was it Santa Cecilia?
Santa Cecilia, yes. Good. Yeah, it was my first concert as a conductor.
Yeah,
I played in the orchestra, in the orchestra of Santa Cecilia. I was guest invited concertmaster for a few projects in the past, but my last one was in 2010, 2011, something like that. So it was pretty while ago.
Yeah. So when did you delete the word violinist from your website then? Because it just says Riccardo Minasi, conductor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
is that not done on purpose or?
Yeah, I already said that several times. All this conducting thing came a little bit step by step and by coincidence. I must say that because it's really true. I never had this incredible desire to be a conductor as a child, as many of my colleagues or during my studies. I was trained as a violinist. I started to play in orchestras, to lead some ensemble, having a lot of chamber music. And then as invited concertmaster, sometimes a few conductors, they ask me, can you take over this rehearsal? Can you help me on that? Can you substitute me for maybe just, I want to listen from the hall. Can you conduct this rehearsal? You know, it happened very often from
practical reasons.
Yes, from practical reasons, from the stand of the concertmaster. And then things became more and more complex. They were asking me, for example, to rehearse a bigger piece in the repertoire. It's one thing is if you have to conduct from the violin, I don't know, an Albinoni concerto. Something else is if you have to conduct a Strauss piece.
Of course.
And then, of course, it's totally utopic to do it from the violin. And then I started to, I don't know, to wave my arms in the air in front of my colleagues trying to get over the rehearsal and to try to say maybe something with sense to make people playing together. In that moment, I realized, okay, if I want to do this job, if I want to help the conductors that candidly are inviting me, I should have a drop of technique or something. And so I start to study a little bit here and there. I did some master class here and there, and here we are. And then thanks to the trust of few persons, I must say, then suddenly I was basically only conducting. Sophie de Lint, for example, the ex-casting manager in the Zurich Opera, now she's the head in the Dutch National Opera. She gave me my first opera on stage. And while in the moment where I had no experience at all in this sense,
wow.
She called me once, she asked me to do this, and I said, well, Sophie, I don't know if I'm able to.
Yeah.
And she said, no, I really... She invests so much in me, but really I was nobody, completely. And other figures, like, for example, Ensemble Resonance, where, can you imagine, the first ever concert I did with them back in...
2014?
No, it was before. Really? That was, I think it was before. Yeah, no, definitely it was before. My daughter was not born yet, so I think it was... 2009, I don't want to say something wrong, but I think it was around that time. It was in the Kleine Saal, in the...
La Salle.
In the La Salle, exactly. This building didn't exist yet.
No.
And they invited me, and the first thing they asked me was to do a Prelude à la Première Nuit d'Enfant in the arrangement by, I don't remember who. And I remember when I received this phone call, I said... Are you sure? Are you calling the right person? I don't know. Did you?
You never did any Debussy or anything before? Or?
I played this music for sure, but yeah. I never conducted it. Something completely different. I said, I don't know if I can. I said, okay, I tried. No, yes, let's do it. There's many situations like that. And or for example, when I did my debut with the Mozarteum Orchestra in Salzburg. It happened also like that. And after the first concert, they asked me to be the new chief conductor there. And it was a strange program because it came up by a cancellation of somebody else. And then Trevor Pinnock gave my name to the board of the orchestra. They invited me. And the program was very strange. We had Helios by Carl Nielsen, the Vesperi Siciliani Ballet by Verdi. What else? Trittico Botticelliano by Respighi.
Wow. Italian, Scandinavian mixed program, kind of
very
across the centuries.
We had even water music by Handel. I mean, it was really Arvo Pärt.
Wow.
It was a very strange program. And so not usual for me to conduct this music. And I went there without any expectation. I was not even imagining that they would have been interested in me as a new chief conductor. But this is what happened. And at the time when they invited me, you know, I never conducted a Beethoven symphony in my life. And so again, I was, are you sure?
Yeah.
And and then afterwards, for the 5 years, almost 6 years I was there, I had to improve my, and to increase
your
my repertoire.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So,
But there must be something going on in terms of chemistry between you and the musicians. And I must tell you, I mean, I've witnessed many conductors during rehearsals. I sneak in and I do observe how do they work, how do they communicate. And it was extremely wonderful yesterday because you are so articulate about what you wish to hear, you know. And I found one very interesting little detail. The German Wikipedia tells me that you have been trained with your mother at first. Mm-hmm. The Italian Wikipedia says, and I will quote it, Riccardo Minasi ha ricevuto le prime lezioni di musica della madre cantante.
Yeah.
Which is just the little difference that it says your mother was a singer or she was singing.
And yes.
That was what I find you do all the time, pretty much. You convey your musical ideas, at least you did that yesterday, entirely by singing everything with such joy and passion and subtleties. And I think it grabs musicians immediately in a way. Not talking now about all the verbal things that you have. You know, this huge frame of reference that you have. Talking about sound, you know, you would say like, you play together like passing, like a little spliff joint or so. You know, it's beautiful, or it has to sound psychedelic. I mean, what other conductor would come up with that frame of reference? And they get it, you know, and they smile and they like it and they follow this lead in a way. And
yeah, it's, I don't know. Well, I don't know if I'm doing something special, frankly. What I know is that I was for many years on their side, you know. So I know by experience how boring, how terribly annoying can be a rehearsal unless you don't achieve to certain results in the quickest amount of time as possible. And it's true. I was trained at really early age. I started with the violin when I was three.
Wow, yeah.
And
it was not Suzuki?
It was Suzuki. Oh, okay. My mom, she's Japanese.
Oh, right, okay.
So I'm half Japanese. And it was a very strange method, you know, how you can catch the concentration and the devotion of a child of that age.
It's, and it must difficult. Have been
of course I don't have kids in front of me, but somehow you have to make things dynamic, and I have to say with every orchestra it's different. Okay, here with the Resonance we developed after so many years of activity together a certain, let's say, vocabulary. So we know each other, and they know, okay, Riccardo now is starting the thing. Okay, now he's starting with those jokes. Ooh, actually, it's becoming the other way around. with others, for example, I have to be, of course, a little bit more
serious.
Yeah, serious, of course. And it also depends how much I can convey, giving a certain amount of information and wishes from the orchestra, if the orchestra is willing to follow my path. You know, it's always different. For example, an incredible experience I had recently was with Berliner Philharmonica. I told them, actually, because, you know, I mean, we know them.
Absolutely.
And we know also the reputation they have. And you know, I was not afraid, but I was very curious, in fact, to see how they could have been reacting to certain requests, etc. So I started rehearsing in a more standard way, I would say. Yeah. Trying to be, of course, dynamic, friendly, as you should always be. And then I was asking them, is it okay if you work in that way? Because I don't know, it's my first time here in front, standing in front of you. And they were extremely receptive. And then they were saying, no, no, please give us, tell us, go for it, go for it. Cool. Are you sure? Go for it. Are you really sure? Yes. And then I started to unlock the thing and I started to be like yesterday, in fact.
And you are referring to this Mozart program that you did with
them?
Yes. It's amazing. I mean, you have all these big shots like Albrecht Meyer and Emmanuel Pahud and all these killer players in the orchestra. And they are all so dedicated and they play really, really well.
I found an incredible dynamic group with such a huge interest about music, about the artistic result. And they were extremely friendly, extremely open to the most crazy request I made, and also in terms, for example, rubato, I was maybe, you know, not for the sake to be different or to do something strange, but just to underline a little bit more what I think is the strategy of a certain piece, of a certain phrase, et cetera, et cetera. And they were extremely receptive. And somehow I managed to convince them that a certain vision, a certain decision for a certain moment was the right one. And it was a very overwhelming experience, I must say. Yeah.
And I think musically, I mean, the result is a bit what Harnoncourt would talk about, the Klangrede, you know, this the stream of talking, but in an Italian way. So it's extremely vivid, it's extremely musical. I mean, even if you speak, I find it sounds musical. You know, the way you articulate your voice, it's really... You get into a field of something that's really very attractive and inspiring, I must say. And
thank you.
Now, I wonder, you have gone to Baroque violin rather early in your career. Yeah. And that was, of course, the heydays of all the historically informed stuff. And you were kind of, it feels to me like bypassing all the ideology about it and were just bringing it back home to where the music originated from, where they wanted to restore Baroque music in a more vivid way. You know, it's not that much of a theory, I find, the way you play. Of course, it's all very trained, but it's different. Did you bring some sun, some warmth into all this authentic playing?
Yeah, I think there's in my approach to the music, any kind of music from any century, there's never been a, let's say, sake of restoration. I don't like so much this word applied to the music, in fact. I was trying, yes, to approach a certain piece with the knowledge of my predecessor and my colleagues. I mean, I'm not the only one doing this job. And I played in many early music ensemble where I learned so much from Giovanni Antonini, from Ottavio D'Antone, from René Jacobs, from many, many others.
Jordi Savall,
oh my gosh, I forgot.
No. Let's not forget.
Of course. Can you imagine, I did my first project with Jordi Savall when I was 16.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you had just left Rome and then you...
I met him when I was 16 in an orchestra in Piemonte, in northern Italy. And then quite soon after, he called me with the Concert des Nations. And I think I learned from him much more than by anyone else, I must say. And bringing warmth. I don't know. You approach a score. You try to understand the meaning, the message that the composer wants to deliver. And then, of course, more information you have around this, better it is.
Sure.
And Yeah, yesterday, for example, to the rehearsal you came, we were talking about a certain bow stroke. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I mentioned a few sources that we have about a certain way of using the bow, and et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, if you apply those things, as, for example, Arnon Kurt, as Roger Norrington said already many, many decades ago, the music suddenly sounds more fresh, sounds more new, more revolutionary. Somehow you have to... we'll have in the next season Eroica.
Yeah.
How you can make again the shock of the premiere of Eroica in Lobkowitz Palace. How you can really convince everyone that what they are hearing, these two punch at the beginning of the first movement, and you can make them the people believing that wait a moment, there's something, there's really the soul of Beethoven coming into Vienna saying, excuse me, can I talk? No, it's coming really right
up front,
right to the spot. Yeah, so yeah, of course, more information you have around, and I think better you can get closer to.
So the historical approach would rather be: what did this music mean at that time, and what a revolutionary concept that was, and to see how do we connect to this.
Yeah, and somehow we are obliged to adapt a little bit to the sound environment we have nowadays, because the conditions were completely different. You can reduce, for example, the setup of the choir or the orchestra for Matthäus Passion, mm-hmm. But we will never achieve the same kind of impact the audience had after the Lent period, where they were not listening to music for 3 months. And suddenly coming to the church and hearing this thing, mm-hmm. For the first time.
What an overwhelm that must have been.
You cannot rebuild the conditions. Maybe I took now an extreme case, but it's always like that.
No, you're right. And all this hearing experience that people bring with them along nowadays,
For sure.
So, concert
I'm trying, let's say, a few things that we must be open, because, for example, with the resonance, we experimented many things coming from the musicological research that were made in the past. And then we were trying to apply them. I remember the first very attempt that we did with this kind of, technical tools, mm-hmm. The first reaction was, no, Riccardo, come on, that cannot work. It doesn't work. I said, look, let's try. They've been using this kind of tool maybe for 50 years. We can try. And now, after having learned how to manage those kind of tools, we can't go back. And going back to the usual way, somehow, it sounds so much cheaper.
Shallow, yeah.
Yeah, it's so, yeah, it's those was things that were open eye elements of my activity, I have to say. Yeah.
So the ensemble would appoint you in 2018 as their conductor in residence, and then they were extending this, and I think they were extending it even before COVID came, because they
extended it 2 times, and then when we were facing the fact that they wanted to continue to work with me and extend it for the third time and say, okay, shall we stop this?
It's becoming a little...
Let's just put, I don't know how they call me, a partner in crime and something like that, I don't remember.
And now you are principal guest conductor, which is quite a pompous title for an orchestra like Ensemble Resonance, you know.
Yeah, it's quite strange. Yeah. Yeah. Then, of course, I'm part of them. I must say, okay, for example, not because I want to come back necessarily to the Berlin Phil debut, but somehow this invitation from Berlin Philharmonic came not only because few members of the orchestra came in when I did the Mahler 3 in Salzburg, but also because they heard about my activity, my Mozart recording with them.
Yeah.
When I received this invitation, I told to the group, I think we should stand all on the podium all together, because otherwise I can't justify my presence there. Because in fact, yeah, it was all the projects I did with them is something completely different than with another orchestra. There's a continued dialogue. You've seen yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, I am also giving a lot of space to when I see that there's a lot of talking going on in the orchestra, is for sure to achieve a certain target. And every section leader is really willing to
give
the best.
Really engaged. And then engaged completely. Coming back to the Boeing situation, there's many ways to skin the cat. I mean, you show like
Absolutely.
Different ways of how
it'll
always sound very alive and,
yes.
and interesting and beautiful. I wonder, to what extent did Ensemble Resonance also pull you into all this contemporary stuff that they love so much? I mean, you are so well known for all this Baroque and all ancient music stuff. And of course, with them, you do some contemporary music. How much really did they pull you into this repertoire?
Well, since my very early age, I was performing a lot of contemporary music.
Okay.
In fact, I was, even when I was still a student, I was playing a lot in the Festival di Nuova Consonanza in Rome, where we had a lot of chamber music, I must say, but just premieres. Of many
First.
Many composers writing a piece and receiving those strange scores and trying to
make sense of it,
to carry the skin at home by the end of the concert. So I had a lot of experience in that. Then for quite a large period of my activity, I abandoned it a little bit, not because I wasn't so much interested, just I was so much involved in other stuff, and so I had no time, in fact. And then, of course, they give me, the thing is that when you have premieres or new commissions, there's always the risk, I must say. In my activity in the recent years, I had some overwhelming experiences. One that I was mentioning just yesterday at dinner with Tobias Rempe and Tim Erik Winsel, the two members of the group of Resonance, we're talking about Vijay Iyer.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
When we did Crisis Mode, the piece by him, or when we did this piece that we commissioned to Rudolf Campe as an introduction for the Beethoven Violin Concerto. Those were incredible experience, but I had also some bad experience, unfortunately, pieces where I couldn't find a logic sense in it, and I was even asking to the composers and they couldn't answer, and when there's no form, there's not a frame around what you're writing, let's say the line between being creative and cheating is really subtle, and so several times I was annoyed, especially in quite recent time when I premiered a piece by a well-known composer and I was asking a few things and this person didn't know his piece.
Oh.
I knew better than him at the piece he wrote. So I, at that moment I said, come on, wait a moment. It's...
That's sobering.
It depends.
What do you do then? Then do you just say, let's forget about that piece, I don't want to do it? Or
That was in the general rehearsal, can you imagine?
So, yeah, okay, that's too late, of course. Yeah, yeah.
But what I can say that it is, I have to try just because to be alive, to find a reason to do that. And in that case, for example, the thing was, the composer doesn't know his piece and the notes are just randomly put on paper with incredibly difficult meter changes. Mm-hmm. And my goal was to carry the orchestra until the end without a mistake. That was like a sportive thing. And I found it exciting somehow. And also people in the orchestra, as a challenge, people in the orchestra liked it because I was done with all those strange subdivisions. Yes, we managed. Yeah, that was like a game. Yeah.
And the audience was celebrating you for surviving this mess?
Actually, the audience was not celebrating so much. We made such an effort. We are super satisfied because we arrived with not so many dead people until the end of the concert. The people was okay. Next.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Let's put it the other way around. What would you expect from a contemporary music piece that it really attracts you?
That's an interesting question. Back to a form, to any form. You know, it's the thing is that composing music nowadays, we had everything. Structuralist, the opposite, the other way around, strange noises, and conservative people. And what we need is new ideas, our new ideas organized in a certain way. You can establish your frame that can be a scale. Mm-hmm. Can be a certain harmonic procedure or a certain idea that can come even outside from the music, from any other form, art form. But you need to establish a little bit the reason for why you are constructing a certain thing, you are conceiving, you are imagining a certain thing. And then out from that, being completely creative. Can be just a single element. I think we should learn from the lesson of the greatest of the past. Think about Beethoven, for example. It's not something I'm saying. I mean, everyone, I think, more or less agrees about this, the fact that he was not a champion in melody. He was not a champion in harmonic innovation. He was not a champion in rhythmical craziness. But he was able to build up and to control the architecture of an entire sonata, quartet, or symphony, or whatever else, just with one of these three elements. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have only rhythmical elements, not particularly innovative, and you lack of the other two elements, you are anyway able to make a piece of 40, 45 minutes long that is convincing. Mm-hmm. This is an incredible skill. And, you know, there are composers that they have few ideas and composers that have an incredible amount of ideas in terms of orchestration or whatever else. And, for example, Beethoven is one of them. Starting a violin concerto with the timpani. Having an incredible harmonic twist just right at the beginning of a piano concerto with the piano starting alone. Having an introduction of the last movement of a symphony. Having an hybrid form, sonata form for a last movement that is also a theme with the variation, with the two fugati. Come on. Having a first movement that is still the longest first movement in the history of the music. There are so many things like that. Roger Norrington was calling the first movement of Eroica a monster. it's true. Is. I mean, it's a joke with all the love we have for the first movement of Eroica. It is, in fact, a monster. And I mean, any other composer trying to manage the three thematic groups with their development and this and that, et cetera, without losing the control and keeping and the track and carrying on the attention of the audience till the end, you must be really an extremely skilled person. And so I think those are the point of reference we should have now to create a new music. Being creative, I know a few cases like that. For example, I would like to mention Alberto Colla, for example. He's an incredible composer. He's a fantastic composer with so many ideas. So many ideas. I don't know why.
Contemporary Italian composer,
yes,
which I don't know.
Yes.
I
have to unfortunately, admit. Now he's he's having some health problem, mm-hmm. and it's a pity that he's not recognized so much nowadays, and not so many are performing his music. I think he's really a very revolutionary composer, and every piece I saw by him has billions of ideas.
So that would be one possibility to program Ensemble Résonance with one of his pieces, for instance.
I would love. The thing is that there are not so many pieces for a small ensemble.
Oh, I see.
That's the problem.
So
it's a more symphonic. But in the future, I hope.
Yeah. As I said, the melodic approach of yours is so very predominant, and so is your rhythmic approach. I mean, you're wonderfully immaculate in the time and in the subdivisions and in all this. Speaking of the contemporary music and the melos, which, if we speak about Nono, for instance, is mm-hmm. so there. I mean, he would never abandon melody, even in the most abstract constructions that he would build. Do you relate to this because of that, or does it? Nono doesn't speak to you that much.
Yeah, no, it does for sure. Probably say it is the fact that we are both Italian, maybe even from two sidereal different parts of
Venice and Rome,
of the country. But there's a little bit this. We can call it also a cliche, but in fact, it's a little bit true that. The singing in Italy somehow it's visceral. It's coming from our stomach. You know, as Italians, very often when we talk about, for example, the early 19th century, with Rossini, Bellini, Donizetti, mm-hmm. Mercadante, and company, we're always a little bit, disappointed because on the other side of the Alps, there were, I don't know, Berlioz, Schubert, Schumann, Mendelssohn, etc. And we are thinking, of course, their construction, their mm-hmm. Their ability to build up a castle was for sure really much more developed. But no one was singing like the Italians. Everyone
was not
just...
Even not Schubert.
Yes, even on Schubert. Yeah, of course. When Schubert was thinking about singing, was somehow referring to the Italians, how the Italians sing. Paganini was not a virtuoso, how he was singing the cantabile from the violin.
Si.
And that was one thing. So somehow there's this cooperation that we have to find somehow between the countries that are on one and the other side of the Alps.
Yeah.
I think we can somehow compensate each other and
inspire each other
for sure.
That's
for
what
sure.
happened in the Baroque era, you know, they would all, you know,
for
do
sure.
the pèlerinage to Italy.
It's been always like that. Even when people was not traveling so much as nowadays, they had always this influence. I mean, Bach never abandoned Germany.
Yeah.
And when he wants to be Italian, he's the most Italian of the Italian composer. I mean, look at his ornaments in his music. Was, yesterday, for example, the day before, when we were talking about the Corelli we are performing now, somebody was asking me, okay, well, from where we can take inspiration for the ornaments in the Corellian style? So look at Bach. Mm-hmm. It's so perfect. And,
I think Luca Bach is always right, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. There's nothing we can do in front of this genius. Yeah.
Ricardo, do you have any goal with the Ensemble Resonance other than just having a brilliant and good and inspiring time with these players, being now their principal guest conductor?
Well, we are facing this big problem. I think we are maybe the worst enemies of ourselves because very often I had very often this comment by audience or people that was writing me, Ricardo, sorry, I cannot understand what's your target. Because with them, for example, we do contemporary music, then now we do this Corelli project.
Yeah.
Then we had Brahms 4 2 months ago when it was.
Fantastic, yeah.
Then we have the Beethoven. We had Belcanto experience that we are going on. Even we had Norma. Mm-hmm. And then the next season we have Capuleti Montecchi. We had the Berlioz with Renick Jean. What else? I mean, it's everything. Pergolesi Stabat Mater, Beethoven Piano Concertos, Carl Philipp Emanuel, etc., etc.
Yeah.
Haydn. We're looking on to do more. Following a little bit more the path of the Viennese school. We did Alban Berg. Mm. We did plenty of things, and so it's difficult. The Mozart, sorry, I forgot. All.
Yeah, sure.
Operas by Mozart, Iphigenie Antoride, Gluck. I mean,
all
so
over
many
the place.
Different things. So many different things. And it's There's not a strategy. Also, because I must confess, personally, maybe I'm not talking for the group, but I never thought and I never had as a principal, let's say, stars to follow the career. Mm-hmm. I really don't care about the career at all. Believe me, really. I can start planting potatoes tomorrow, and I'll be the happiest person in the universe.
Truly? Really.
Yeah, absolutely. I can stop tomorrow. There's no problem.
Do you have a garden?
I have a great terrace, and and I plant potatoes and onions and garlic, etc., and many other things. But the problem I'm fighting with the birds.
And so they like you planting too much.
Yes, they love the thing I'm cultivating there. But I have the plan to have a garden one day. Actually, we do have a garden in the States, but I'm not spending so much time there, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And it's in a very cold place. So
not much growing there?
No, not so much. I mean, it's in Maine, you know?
Maine is a nice area.
I mean, it's a fantastic place. But as they may know, they say there are two seasons, the winter and August.
So yeah, you must love that. Otherwise, you're really screwed.
So, yes. Yeah, so the goals, you know, just to answer to your questions, are just to have fun, I must say, and to explore and to learn. I'm super happy. I'm always learning with them. Even if I'm doing a Corelli Concerto Grosso. We were talking about the fact that it's somehow music of propaganda.
Oh.
It is. Yeah, but this idea...
In which way?
Of course, because Corelli is always Apollinean, is super gentle, and formally is very symmetric, blah, 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 and quite boring, maybe. But we have to put somehow in the context, sorry that I'm using this word, maybe it's a little bit stupid, but the fact that Corelli planned politically this style for... 20 years before he published the Sonatas Opus 5, the 1st January 1700.
Oh.
It's not a date that he picked up like, randomly. Look, today is the 1st January 1700. No, it was planned. Like the start of a new era, because Clemente XI, Clemens XI, the Pope, Papa Albani, at the time... He was really extremely active. He was an incredible political figure that was trying somehow to restore a certain range of power and influence all over Europe. For instance, with the French court and with Louis XIV and in Dresden, for example, the Catholic, let's say, places, exactly, Saxon, exactly. So after the Concilio di Trento and the mm-hmm. post-Tridentine church, they were trying to recuperate few of the zone of influence that they lost because of the Lutheranism, of course, the Lutherans. Somehow Corelli was the perfect person because in Rome, in the Vatican, they never had, after Palestrina, somebody that was not involved in the operatic world, that was not married, was possibly casto, you know, even if he had this very good friend, Matteo Fornari, with whom they lived together for more than 25 years in the Palazzo della Cancelleria with Pietro Toboni, the cardinal. And after his death, Corelli left everything to him. And it was the perfect figure. And they were thinking, for example, you know, the music of the propaganda of the regime is very, it's something common. Louis XIV was in need of a music for the regime. He asked to Mazzarino, what do we do? Wait a moment, let me call a friend from Tuscany. He calls Giovanni Battista Lulli. Lulli, we need something to express power, grandeur, and so on.
And out comes Lulli.
You know what? Ta-dam, ba-da-ba-dam, ba-da-ba-da-ba-dam, ta-dam, French Overture. Oh, good idea. That's the music of the propaganda. Corelli, what we need to restore. And of course, Papa Albani was asking to Pietro Ottoboni. Pietro Ottoboni somehow was a figure like Baron von Swieten was for the emperor. Mm-hmm. You know, those figures that somehow they were the pillow between the power
the culture.
And the artist. Mm-hmm. When Baron van Swieten at a certain moment was in charge to find somehow to recuperate the Germanic identity in Vienna. Because in Vienna there were only Italians and Eastern European musicians.
Hungarians.
Yes, Hungarians, Czech, etc., etc. And the only one that they couldn't cancel was Gluck, because of course he was really a compositore di corte, the compositore mm-hmm. di corte, so it was impossible to cancel him. But all the others, Mislivček, Cannabich, Van Al, Vranitsky, all of those, when the Eroica was performed the first time, was performed together with the great symphony in flat major by Vranitsky. Mm-hmm. Eroica was booed from the beginning till the end. Vranitsky symphony was acclaimed as the greatest of the new symphonies, and no one is playing Vranitsky anymore. And so on. You know, there's always a political reason. I'm not taking part of this or that. I'm not really.
No need. Yeah.
Yes, but for example, in the Corelli case, for sure it's the music of the propaganda. And if you approach it just in a gentle way, because we are all friends, we are all nice in front of Maria Gesù, etc., etc., it's not that
work.
The message.
No. You miss the point then.
Miss the point. It's really a reproduction. It's giving sound to San Pietro, to San Giovanni Laterano, to Santa Maria Maggiore, to those massive, colossal, crazy, golden castles.
Yeah. Buildings and structures.
For
and
sure, for sure.
Representations of power.
Yeah, for
ultimately,
sure.
Yeah. So that was a very beautiful historical lecture. And my last question wanted to be, are you a lust-driven person? And now I see you are certainly a lust-driven person, but you are also like in all these theoretical and historical contexts. And because you say, you know, if it's about planting potatoes, I could do that because it's just my joy.
I'm not saying for to be a snob and naive. Really, I'm saying, you know, I'm coming from a very humble background. Mm-hmm. I was born in at the time was a pretty, let's say, poor zone of Rome. Was not in the center at all, and kids at school at the time were going to school every morning, playing football during the lunch break, and going to the bar playing flipper.
Afterwards,
or doing something else. Mm-hmm. And I had, for example, three kids in my school that died for heroin at the time, just to give you an example. It was a quarter of Rome where we were not used to speak Italian. We were speaking with a dialect of Rome.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I have a very strong Roman accent.
Ah, okay.
Yes. And my fellow in the school was Francesco Totti. Uh-huh. He's 1 year older than me, but we were in the same elementary school when we were kids.
Tell me about Francesco Totti. Who is he?
Francesco Totti. You don't know Francesco Totti.
No.
Shame on you.
Yeah. I don't.
Francesco Totti is not in activity anymore, but. Is the king of Rome, is a football player.
Lazio, yeah. Or what?
Roma, per carità, Roma. AS Roma, and a great player, a fantastic player, possibly one of the greatest football player we ever had
in Italy,
yes. Oh. And and Francesco Totti was always since he was a kid, was a fantastic person. He was able to make group, mm-hmm. you know,
to bond
together people. Maybe I learned a lot about conducting from him. I'm not kidding.
Wow, interesting.
It's possible, because he was kind of with everyone. He was able to really to put on the spotlight the skills of everyone, even me. I had and I still have
two left feet,
two banana feet. But somehow he was putting me as a goalkeeper, and was motivating me because I was one of the few kids. I was very small at the age compared to the other kids in the school. And sure what? And I was one of the few that was brave enough to really fall on the floor and fend on and doing whatever to catch this ball.
And by this, you were able to actually catch some.
Yes, and so I was very motivated from him. Wow, you're good, Minasi. Yeah, go for it. And that was really a huge motivation. I felt always, yeah.
Fantastic. So in this upbringing, there was no, he is the little violin person and he was too tender. No, you were...
I started to get interest in this, in the music, when I was 10 years old, in fact. Between 3 and 10 was a drama. I couldn't understand why my mom was obliging me to do this, because she was really obliging me to do this. I didn't want it. I wanted to play football with other kids. That's it. And then when I was 10 years old, I met this kid in the school. He was 1 year older than me. His name was Ricardo, as me, mm-hmm. Richard, actually, to be correct, from South Africa, uh-huh. that played the violin so much better than me. And that had an incredible father that was a music lover with a huge collection of recordings of LPs at home, like an enormous collection. And we have a very enormous
variety
culture. He knew everything about everything.
Oh, fantastic.
And meeting Ricardo was really a shock, because they said, okay, wait a moment. And I got interested. And we started to go to concerts together. And basically on the Tuesdays, we were always at the Oratorio del Gonfalone, where we were hearing mostly chamber music. On Friday, we were in Via della Conciliazione to listen to the other season of chamber music. And then on Saturday or Sunday, we were to the symphonic concerts. That was like every week.
Wow.
Activity. So I don't know how many billions of concerts I heard every week.
Fantastic.
I mean, for many years, and that was. And then, for example, not buying the breakfast, the money that my parents they were giving me for the lunch break, I was saving it
for concert tickets.
No, to buy recordings. Records. To a recording. So I remember every week, almost every week, I was able to buy a CD.
It was already CDs back then.
Yes. Yeah. It was already with the CDs. And I remember also some LP, also some cassette, because maybe the cassette you could buy too. No?
Yeah.
And I was able, and I remember it was when I was waiting that moment, that specific moment. Okay, now I can go. Oh, what I want to buy this recording of Yudi Menuhin, but there's also the new by Joshua Bell. Wait a moment, there's also this. I was very, of course, violinistic focused at the beginning.
Sure.
I remember when I was a kid. And I learned so much from this. I remember the joy to come at home, opening this recording, looking the picture for half an hour, you know.
Absolutely.
Stupid things. Maybe now, but I still remember the smell of the booklet, you know.
And all this is somehow gone. I mean, all these physical sound carriers, CDs, LPs, somehow they come
back. Maybe there are other things. Yeah. I think... you know, we are nostalgic about the human being has always the tendency to be nostalgic. When we were kids, we are almost the same age.
Yeah.
When we were kids, we had our parents that were nostalgic. In my times, we had LPs. We had this strange thing. This
little one.
Okay. And nowadays they have Spotify. Oh, sorry. The platforms, et cetera, et cetera. They don't care about that. But they don't care because they don't have memory of LPs, of CDs, of those things.
Yeah, now it's gotten a style to have LPs again, you know, to be like a little different.
It's normal. It's fine. Yeah. If I must be nostalgic, I'm nostalgic about the fact that I don't see any more kids playing on the streets. When I was a kid, I remember our football places were Piazza del Popolo in Rome. Even before school, because I was coming from outside the center, but from the middle school I was doing school in the center of Rome, and that was a big discovery. I remember we were meeting all the kids at 7 o'clock in the morning to play football before.
To have an hour before
the class. So we took it very seriously. Or after school, we were going to Piazza Farnese to play, or to Campo dei Fiori when they were cleaning up after the market. You know, I was living in the center in that way.
And now even in Italy, they're all afraid of, you know, all kinds of bad things that
it
might happen to their kids.
It doesn't exist anymore. No one can touch a fountain. No one can touch... we were sitting, eating the pizza on the stones in front of Palazzo Farnese. And now no one can touch it. Okay, it's a palazzo built up by Michelangelo, of course, but somehow was in contact with
the people,
with the society.
Were, yeah.
And now you can't.
Now
touch
it's all
this.
Like only it's sites
like a
to sacra be
reliquia, you know. It's annoying. I don't see. I don't want to say that you have to use the Fontana di Fiume by Bernini as a swimming pool. I don't say that, but somehow.
Unless you're Anita Ekberg or somebody.
Exactly. That was another fantasy. Yeah, Fontana di Trevi.
Fontana di Trevi.
Yes.
Si.
But
would you also say that the Italians have gotten a little more cautious with their kids than they were in former times?
For
you know,
sure.
Like in Germany, nobody dares having kids going outside when it's getting dark. It's a drama. You can't do that anymore. You know.
Yeah. That is true. But for sure. I remember how much we were not. I won't say abandoned, but somehow left by
your own devices.
Yes. Since we were kids, without telephone, where are you? Where have you been?
Without tracking the cell phone.
Yeah, now he is playing. Stuff like that. I don't know. We are becoming a little more obsessive about this. Okay, we had also terrible situation. But also, if you hyper-control, you avoid that a kid can make experiences. For example, with Riccardo, I remember we were doing a never-ending promenade, walking around the
along
city.
Along
the city. And I remember when we end up in the Chiesa of Santa Pollinare, close to Piazza Navona, where they had at the time, because they were close to the Institute of Gregorian chant, and they were singing Gregorian. And for the first time I heard the Gregorian in my life, I remember it was a shock. I couldn't believe to my ears. So, well, look at this. For example, from that, this all is connected with another question we were talking about the more information you have. When we were playing the Christmas concerto by Corelli the other day, for example, and we start down, pam, 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 this incipit. What is it? It's a Gregorian canone. Is the Benedictus from the canone post-tridentino. Is a Benedictus qui venit in nomine Domini. This is the Gregorian. This is the incipit of the G minor concerto by Corelli. And so you should approach it in a certain way. It's already giving you how to perform these first four bars.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it in all the possible way because people just was missing the information.
Yeah.
If you know that is a
Gregorian chant, then
or for example, when I went to the Anglican Church in Via Napoli, close to Piazza della Repubblica in Rome, and the people of the Assemblea, they were reading the Messiah by Handel. They were reading instrumentalist people from. They were just performing very badly, of course, the Messiah, the complete Messiah.
Which is quite a piece.
Yes, and I couldn't believe to me, wow, but can I participate? Yes, come, do you have a violin? Yes, go. Crazy thing, and I discovered those things because just we were walking around the city. It was a city that was offering a lot, but any city is offering a lot, especially, I think, in this country. I mean, the level of preparation of everyone here in this country is we dream to have something like that in Italy. We don't have it. And but of course, I was talking about the Chiesa Santa Apollinare. It's the same church. I mean, it's the same. The church is in the same building from where disappeared Emanuela Orlandi, and which is one of the biggest Italian drama. I think it has been 41 years ago that this young girl disappeared. I really hope now that they reopen the case that somebody will speak out, will talk out to find where this girl end up. So
this case didn't really cross the Alps, so we are not really aware of.
You don't know anything about Emanuela Orlandi. Well, it was I can't talk a lot about this, but a case of a girl, 15 years old, that disappeared. They promised that she was a Vatican citizen. And right after, just a few weeks after her disappearance, many theories and many stories came up. like that she was somehow the object of the exchange with the liberation of Ali Akça, that was the guy, the Turkish guy that tried to kill the Pope.
Yeah.
And then the secret services went in, and somebody was thinking about a sexual scandal in the Vatican. Somebody was talking about that about the money of the bank of the Vatican at the time. I mean, many theories arise, and since 41 years,
it's not settling somehow, because this girl never reappeared. Yeah.
And this family, there's still the mother of Emanuele Orlandi. She's over 90 years old, I don't know. And her brother, that is an hero, in my opinion, that is trying with all his forces since 41 years to find his sister. Come on.
Crazy.
It's crazy. And, so this church, okay, they were. I learned the Gregorian Cant, but at the same time, it was the building from where disappeared this poor girl. Hey, giving freedom to the kids, see? It's all related. Balance. Finding a balance is the most difficult thing, I think, in the life in general. Right? I think, for me, balance is the biggest issue in general.
That's a very good point of view. Also balancing all the musical aspects, in life. Being kind, being clear, being warm,
it's the most challenging
structured.
And when you don't find a good balance, yin and yang, you say, then the disaster are happening.
They knew a thing or two, the yin and yang people. Riccardo, I thank you so much.
Grazie.
It was really a great pleasure talking to you and listening to you. Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk. Der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.